I won't hold you down.
That's a canvas.
Oh my god.
Look at that.
That's pretty good.
I know, right?
Your pads must be 13-inch pads, though.
Oh my god, they were the widest.
Oh, do you like? Oh, pads are what, 11 inches now?
11.
That's the max. Remember when they dropped it from 12 to 11? Everyone was losing their minds.
Yeah, like, I remember. You know, I remember because that was the first time I ever ordered a pair of custom equipment. I finished playing junior. And I wanted the Justin Pogge CC or Reebok P1s.
Yeah.
So I spent $3,000. I'm in college. I have no money. Spent $3,000. Buy custom exact replicas of the Justin Pogge sets. 2 days before I get them, RBK comes out and says, we're no longer making 12-inch pads. We're only making 11s. So I have them for like 2 weeks. I try a pair of 11-inch pads. I'm like, holy shit, this is way better. So I sold them, and I bought a pair of 11-inch pads, had them for like 3 weeks max.
That sucks.
Bad life choices.
That sucks so bad. I remember when I bought my first set of custom V2s. It was like around that time, and I was like, should I get 11 or 12? And I remember I bought them at Kineski's, and I asked Joel, I was like, do they make 11 and a half? He's like, no, you're an idiot. Just get 11-inch pads.
Oh, remember the... Remember the flight? Flight where their pads started at 12 and then they slowly went into like 9 at the boot?
No. It went the other way. The boot was like 13. And by the time you got to the top, they were like 7 inches.
Flight did a lot of things that just they should be ashamed about.
Remember they had the rolls all the way up the pad?
Yeah.
They were cylinders all the way up the boot through the shin.
If you look at the old Heaton or like Brian's pads that the guy Trevor Kidd comes to mind, his Flames gear, that they would compress so much that by the end the boot was just so wide.
Well, how did you tie yours down? So after a game you'd strap it like the top thigh strap down to like the heel strap. So like pads were about this big, you're carrying them out through the arena. And they're just that you take a 36-inch pad and you shrink it down to 26 inches.
Oh, yeah. Or like when you first get a new pair of pads, what's the first thing you do? You buy a chair or a bench and you break them in crushing them.
I remember I bought a pair of Vaughn Legacy pads, and this was when I was playing with the DeWilt, and the DeWilt were over, and Rick DeWilt saw my pads, and his their older brother Jordan was a goalie. He's like, oh, you got a set of new pads? He's like, you're gonna have to put those under the table for at least a week to wear them.
I was like, oh yeah, I remember I used to do that. Imagine we saw one of our goalies doing that right now.
Oh my god. Just break all that foam, all that engineering, just right out the window.
Yeah, don't worry about any of the science that went into the product. Just destroy them.
Yeah.
There are some weird goalie trend. Thigh boards.
Curtis Curve.
Oh my god. The Curtis Curve. Oh, Curtis Curve. You're going to paddle down, you're vulnerable.
No, it had the hook on it at the end. Remember trying to play a puck with that hook on the top?
He was using Christian sticks, right?
They were a Christian stick, yeah.
What was the one where right, like, on the shaft, right where your hand stopped, it, like, curved down so that when you went paddle down, it would be fully along the ice?
That was the Curtis Curve.
Was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you go paddle down so much. Made by Christian. He talked about that in his book, I believe.
Curtis Curve. I'm Googling that right now. That's hilarious.
That wasn't it. Was it a Cujo thing?
100%.
So, or maybe it was a Christian thing and they just like, hey, use our sticks.
I think maybe it was just the guy who designed his name was Curtis.
Overdrive?
Curtis, I think
Curtis
that was
Smith. Overdrives.
Overdrives. I thought overdrives. Those were the coolest.
It could be a massive blurt, but I feel like that's Cujo. The only two sticks I'm seeing here are Christian and Vic.
Vic did a Curtis curve?
They did. Vic
was
did.
It called the Vic. Victor curve?
We'll put Vic in the category of flight where there's just a lot of shame there. Remember the first time you went to Don Simmons though in Fort Erie and how
so
amazing it was?
So
never sad. Been.
What?
Never.
Come on.
I might be the only goalie guy never went there once.
I don't know if we can call you a goalie guy if you've never even been to Simmons.
My old man would just come home with pads. He was a service manager at a mechanic shop. He would just come home with pads. And I'm like, where did you get these? Client. So I'm playing on a blue and a red team, and I'm using yellow, bright yellow and black and red pads. Like, swag points, -8. But the old man is like, these are pro returns. These are really good. You're going to wear them. I have no choice. I'm 11 years old. I'm putting on what the guy brings me home.
Yeah.
Alba, what were your first pair of pads?
It's funny that Derek mentions that, because the first pair of pads that I had, my dad just brought home for me one day. They were blue and orange Cooper pads that were about 7 sizes too big. And I think I was 8 playing house league, and I wore them at practice. And by the end of the practice, I was bawling because I could not move. I was just laying on my back, flopping around. And then the next day, he gave them back, brought them back, and we went to Kineski's and bought all black Brian's Airlite, fit like a glove. They were amazing.
Oh, Team All Black.
Oh yeah,
big Team All Black guy now
for sure.
That's basically the same as mine. My first pair of pads were CCM Heaton's, like the Marty Brodeur ones with the little devil tail.
Oh yes. Yeah.
And my dad got all my gear, $300 from a guy down the street. He used to play with my older brother, but quit being a goalie. So $300, head to toe gear. And this was right around the time where like butterfly pads just came out.
Okay.
So I was so rattled because the CCM Eatons, when you do a butterfly, they wouldn't, the pad would not face the puck. You know, like the old style butterfly, like the Jocelyn Thibault, where basically the pads are just going right down.
Yes.
So frustrating, because all I wanted was butterfly pads. And I had to learn with these CCM Heatons, my knees exposed, trying to make kick saves, and that was brutal.
You know what? You know what the advantage of that is, though? Is that you have to learn how to do a butterfly perfectly, and even in those pads, it doesn't work.
Nowadays, yeah, it's true.
Nowadays, you just, with any set of pads, you go down on your knees, and you're in a butterfly. So they don't really have to learn the technique. The pads just do it for you.
Yeah, it's called progress.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. Technology progresses, and it's a good thing.
Alva wants everyone to go back to deer hair pads.
like the ones behind you.
If you want a new pair of pads, you got to go back and shoot an elk.
Hey, stuff. Hey, back in the day, deer hair was a real selling feature.
Cowhide. This is waterproof cowhide. Do you remember the pads that had it was like a block that went on the back of your calf?
Yes.
Do you remember those? And they made the pads sit more flat.
I actually do remember those. Yeah.
Man, back in the day, we could find anything we wanted to do to cheat. Like,
yeah,
2x4s across the top of our pants to make our chest go up. Like, Jamie, what did you, it's probably long enough away now. What did you do in college with your chest protector?
It wasn't college. It was my last year of junior.
So I'm pretty sure this is college too.
No, I never did in college. I wore a Bauer and it was pretty big. But my last year of junior, so when I came from the BCHL where you didn't have to wear neck guards for one, which is nice, to the OJ where they forced you to wear neck guards. The first thing I did was I took a neck guard and I cut it so that basically it was about this wide. And I had my dad sew it into the chest protector so only about like this, the third of an inch would stick up. But that, you know, that nail or the TAC logo that you have to like certified, that was like visible. So a ref was like, hey, you have to have a neck guard. Like, look, it's right here. And more than one team complained about it. And then on top of that is I was like, okay, well, the shoulder floaters are a little low in my gray CCM, or I guess it was a Reebok Premier 2. So I bought a used Velocity V4 chest protector, cut the shoulder floaters off them, stitched them on top of my shoulder floaters that were already there in the Reebok. So I had these massive shoulders. I had a warped up neck guard. I was using completely different arms, absolute Frankenstein chest protector. But I definitely cheated there. And I think someone called me out on it once, but I never had in trouble for it.
So welcome aboard, guys. We're joined by a pro hockey player. Not a goaltender, but a pro hockey player. Guy's got a pretty long resume. Montreal native, moved to Stoney Creek. Junior hockey at major junior level. Played U Sports, played in the Coast, played in the AHL. Has now put a couple years under his belts in Europe. currently in Germany now. Welcome to the show, Nick Pageau.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Paj, we're going to get into it right now. What is the current situation that you're going through with the whole pandemic? Like, what's happening?
Oh, well, we found out, I think it was March 10th, that the season was going to be shut down. And then after that, it was just a matter of, you know, getting flights out of here. Our team is sponsored by Iceland Air. And so, you know, they do all the bookings through Iceland Air and whatnot. And our flight was booked for March 24th. And I think it was March 23rd. In the morning, I checked the status of the flight and it was canceled. So I called the lady from the team in charge of the bookings and stuff. And she got back to me and said that our booking had been, Iceland Air was just sharing their bookings with Air Canada. Well, I've got a pug chihuahua mixed dog and he's considered snub-nosed and Air Canada does not allow him to fly in cargo with them. And he's 2 or 3 kilograms too heavy to fly in the cabin. So obviously we weren't able to fly with them. And now we're just stuck. Iceland Air is operating, I think, at 14% of their scheduled flights. They did 260 layoffs last week. 92% of their crew was reduced to part-time. And, you know, CEOs and employees were all taking 20% or more cuts on their salary. They're no longer operating to Toronto, so they're still taking bookings on their website, but they're sharing everything with Air Canada. So right now we're stuck trying to find someone who will let us fly home with our dog.
So everything's really up in the air right now. So what's life like in Germany at this moment for you as a, you know, a Canadian stuck in a foreign country, not allowed to leave?
Yeah. I mean, my town's pretty quiet right now. We've got some severe self-isolation requirements and, you know, more so than Ontario. I mean, I saw the list of 75 businesses that are allowed to be open in Ontario. It's crazy. It seems they would have been better off giving us a list of what was closed.
Yeah.
Here, I mean, only the essential things like grocery store, pharmacies and stuff like that are open. Other than that, everything's pretty much closed. You're not allowed to be outside unless you're, you know, walking your pet or with someone from your household. You're not allowed to meet in public with, you know, people that live in a different household and stuff like that. So we've just been basically in the apartment the whole time, and we've got a little parking lot out back that's kind of fenced in that, you know, we can let the kid out to run around during the day every now and then to burn off some energy. But, you know, gets pretty boring day after day to do that.
Oh, it looks like you have something to say.
No, I'm sympathetic, man. It doesn't sound easy. I mean, we're people are self-isolating over here, but the rules aren't as strict as they are in other parts of the world where you can't be outside unless you have a reason to, like something like walk your dog, and you can't meet other people outside. So we're going through something over here, but it sounds like in Europe where the population density is just so much greater, it kind of leads to a whole nother set of rules and stringencies that go along with that.
So. Yeah. And we're a few weeks ahead of you guys, right? You know, this has been going on over here for a few weeks now where it's kind of just hitting Canada in the last week or so. So, you know, if things keep trending upwards with the amount of people contracting the virus, I'm sure the requirements will be a little stronger back home as well.
Yep.
All right. A little bit of a brighter note. So obviously this is our Eugene goaltending goalie podcast. How did you get involved coming to be a shooter extraordinaire for Bouch?
I was working out at Battlefield and Bouch came in one day and said, "Hey, I pay my shooters. Do you want in?"
that's a big selling feature right there.
Well, let's start right to the OHL. You played the Belleville Bulls in the Ontario Hockey League. Kind of just talk us through that experience. What was it like going from, I guess, Junior A Tier 2 into the OHL in Belleville?
It was felt like a big step, to be honest. I mean, you know, I played 1 year junior A in Hamilton there for the Red Wings, and then that was the year I was drafted, 2004. Played a year with the Red Wings, and then moved on to Belleville after that. Different life, you know, being away from home when you're 16, 17 for the first time, and playing in that league. To me, the OHL at the time was the NHL to a guy my age. So, I mean, that's kind of what it felt like too. It's, you know, you're going to school a couple hours a day, getting off early, going to practice, spending time on the bus, 68 game schedule. So, yeah, it was a pretty cool experience. I really enjoyed it.
And then from there, you go on to St. FX, U Sports. And then you make the jump to the East Coast Hockey League. What was your experience like overall in the East Coast? I mean, we had a guy on last week who's a East Coast kind of journeyman. I just want to hear what it's like from a player's point of view. For those that know, ECHL teams don't carry four lines, three lines, 6D or play a night, and you still have that same schedule. So what was that like for you, having to go through that grind of a schedule?
It was tough at first because, you know, a lot of these teams are owned by NHL teams. They've got their signed players, and you know, those guys are always going to be in the lineup before a free agent signing. My first year of the coach, we had a great coach, Troy Mann. He now coaches the Belleville Senators. He was a big fan of having veterans in the lineup, guys with experience. So it took me some time to kind of break through and be in the lineup on a consistent basis. I think the first 12 or 13 games of the season, I may have played one healthy scratch the rest of them. And then I ended up playing 23 games that year, got hurt in January, was out for 9 months. Came back the following year, played basically the whole season, played 64 games. And then in late March, I got called up to the American League with the Oklahoma City Barons, and finished off the season there. But yeah, just to answer the question about the coast, you know, it is a little bit of a grind. You play, I think my first season was 72 games. 72 games you're supposed to play. I was lucky enough that in the West there in Bakersfield, California, we were taking some pretty short bus rides in-state. I mean, we had Stockton that was 3.5 hours away. We had Ontario that was 2.5 hours away. And then any other team outside the state, you know, we were busing to LAX and flying out. We played in Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah, Boise, Idaho, Anchorage, Alaska. So some of those days, even with the flying, could be some pretty long days. I mean, you bus 2 hours from Bakersfield to LAX. You take a flight, usually to a connection. If you're going to Alaska, you fly to Seattle and then Seattle to Anchorage. So some of those days were 12, 13, 14-hour travel days regardless. Plus a 72 game schedule, you know, it can definitely be a grind.
So after playing 3 years in North America, you decided to go to Europe, and you signed in Norway with Frisk Asker, right? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yep.
So before we get into, you know, a big injury you had in your first year in Europe, what made you decide to, you know, to make the jump overseas?
The year before that, 2015-16, I split half the season between the ECHL and the AHL. Norfolk Admirals in the ECHL, and then the Bakersfield Condors that are now the American Hockey League team for the Edmonton Oilers. You know, it was just, I was 28 years old at the time. I was noticing that it didn't matter how well I was playing. If I wasn't on an NHL contract, you know, it was going to be really hard for me to stick around. So I thought for family reasons that it would be better to go to Europe, and where we could all be together and you know, just play here, where the schedule was shorter, the travel was a little bit less, and you know, that was a big factor right there.
Now, this was Albo's question, so I'm gonna let him ask it about your injury.
Yeah, I actually found out about this from your brother. I ran into him back in Stony Creek, and I asked about you. I said, is your brother Nick still playing hockey? I know he's playing pro for a while. And that was right around the time where you had that head injury. So he told me a little bit about it, but I would love to hear what you have to say about it. I'm imagining it's something that not a lot of guys would bounce back from. I'm sure it wasn't easy. So yeah.
Yeah, we were playing in Ontario, California. It was January 2014. Like I said, it was my 23rd game of the year there, my first season pro. And I was just boxing out a guy in front of the net, and his D-man had walked the line and shot the puck high and wide. And by the time I turned to find the puck, it was already coming at my face. So, you know, I like tucked my chin, and it just hit me right in the middle of the helmet. And basically shattered everything, shattered both my orbital bones, the bridge of my nose, and left a depressed fracture in the front of my skull.
Damn! What was the rehab like? Like, was there a time where you're thinking I might not come back from this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I spent 5 days in the hospital after that. One on the road where it happened, and then I got driven back to Bakersfield. Had the surgery, I think. 2 days later, I was in the hospital for 5 days, and you know, I was pretty pessimistic that I'd be back playing anytime soon. I mean, I had some doctors telling me that it would never happen, and thankfully the two surgeons that operated on me weren't those doctors. You know, they thought I'd make a full recovery and be good to go, and sure enough, it was 9 months later to the day I played my first game back on October 9th in the exhibition game in the East Coast.
Wow. Was there any hesitance in your game when you came back after a big injury, especially taking a puck in the face? I'm just going to relate to goalies as well. I know sometimes a young goalies, you take a stinger, you know, in the knee or something, you're a little hesitant to come back. But for you, you suffered a massive injury. You know, was there any hesitation in your game when you came back, or was it same old as soon as you hopped on the ice?
No, I think, you know what, what's weird with that injury is that when I came back, I was just so hungry to play again that, you know, there wasn't any hesitation in my game and stuff like that. I mean, that year I even had two fights, which, I mean, I'm not a fighter, but that was the last season I had a fight in those two fights. And then, my first year in Norway where I broke my ankle, I missed the entire season there too. When I came back from that one, I was more hesitant to, you know, be in front and shots coming at your legs and stuff. You know, that was more worrisome to me.
And speaking of Norway, what's life like over there? I was there very briefly, but it just seems like such a, you know, the kind of place where everything is so nice and put together and the people are so sophisticated. I mean, what's it like living there and working there?
I loved it. It was, you know, it's a beautiful country. It's everything's so modern. They have so much money. I mean, if you're going from Canada to Norway or any other country to Norway and you got to put up with the prices there, you're like, oh my God, this is insane how expensive everything is. I mean, to them, it's just, that's life. It's normal to them. So they don't see it. But to an outsider going in there, it's pretty expensive. I mean, I think the first beer I had there was like $16 Canadian at the bar.
That's wild.
Yeah. But, living there was awesome. The people are extremely laid back, extremely friendly. I mean, we did 2 years there. My daughter was born there. We had a great, great experience at the hospital there in Norway. So, nothing but good things to say about Norway.
And you make the move to the Allsvenskan, signing with Carlos Corona. And then now, after 1 year in Sweden, you sign in the Delta with EHC Freiburg or Freiburg?
Freiburg.
EHC Freiburg. And you have a career year. What was life like in Germany before, you know, the season was canceled and everything happened?
It was good. I mean, I'm playing in an awesome city. Freiburg is it's about 230,000 people. Beautiful architecture downtown. They've got this big cathedral that I'm not even sure when it dates back to. It's old. It's really old, but really nice. Our rink a little older. The rinks in Germany are crazy. We had some rinks this year that only had two walls. I mean, you're basically playing outdoors. Our rink was a little older, but what a fan base. Great fans, very loud, very on top of you. And you know, we had quite a few sellouts this season. This is a last place team last year, and you know, we We came in at the beginning of the year. Every team in this league had said we were going to finish last again. We ended up finishing third, surprising a lot of people. And, you know, we averaged a way higher attendance that was budgeted for this year. It was just a really good experience as well. Life in Germany was normal. It was, just like you'd expect it anywhere, right? Nothing. People walking around, going about their business. People love patios and eating outdoors here, and love their beer.
Before all the goalies get bored of the player talk and turn it off, do you notice any difference between, I guess, not skill level, but you played in three European countries and in North America. Do you notice a difference in just the goalie's ability or just the way they play from league to league as a player?
Yeah, I think, even just the jump from the American League to the ECHL to the American League, the goalies are much, much harder to beat. Goalies are bigger, they're quicker, they seem more confident, and they move a lot better. I mean, they're more technically wise. In Europe, you're getting a lot of those ECHL goalies, still good goalies, but not quite the step that a number one AHL goalie would be or something like that.
Do you think shooting with Bouge and being around so many goalies and hearing the goalie coach talk, do you think it's helped you figure out how to beat goalies or figure out goalie tendencies at all?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a game for me, especially as a defenseman, you don't have a whole lot of time to think about how you're going to beat the goalie. I mean, I'm not usually in that close. I'm taking a lot of shots. A lot of my goals this season were one timers on the power play. I definitely think that being around that in the summer, you kind of get an idea of how a goalie's thinking, what he's looking at when you got the puck or in a certain position and stuff like that. So yeah, of course that helps to try and beat them a little bit, but the advantage is still in the goalie's hands.
You're going to introduce your new guest, Paj?
Yeah, sorry. This is Naya. She's two.
She's skating yet?
No. She likes to come on the ice after wins, though.
Only wins. Everyone likes to be part of a winner.
Only wins, yeah.
Do you do like the fan thing where you go, after wins or what?
Yeah, every home win. So, pretty cool.
Shake hands with their team after every game.
Yeah, until the playoffs, then they had the Corona rule. Or right before playoffs, I think there was like three games left, and they told us we couldn't shake hands anymore. So it was fist bumps after that.
I always felt like it was weird, like in England, where like you're playing the same team back to back nights, you have to shake hands with them after the game, and you're gonna see these guys the next night.
Yeah,
I wasn't a big fan of that.
We had. I think we played a team three times in a span of 4 or 5 days in February or January, due to some arena availability issues. And like you said, I mean, you get into some heated games with them, and then you got to shake hands and play them again next game. So it is different, but there's not as much fighting over here anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
What's the travel like for you guys in Germany?
My closest trip was, I think, 2.5 hours. A lot of 5-hour trips, 4 or 5 hours. Had a 8-hour, a 10-hour. The traffic is just crazy here. Hey, keep your shirt on. There's 83 million people here in Germany. So we're always leaving, especially on a Friday, 2-3 hours before we should be leaving, just to make it through the traffic.
Do you ever do any multiple teams on the same trip?
Like I said, we only did it twice this year, where we went up and stayed in a hotel. So the first time we went up, we played Kassel, which was about 5 hours away. And then we continued on from there to Weisswasser, which was another 5 hours. And then the next time we stayed, we only went up for one game. We went up, it was 6 hours away. Stayed in a hotel, and actually after the game, we couldn't come back because there was this big hurricane storm. So we ended up staying on the road an extra night. And yeah, I mean, that's the travel. It's not the best. It's not the most optimal for trying to go and play a game on the road, but every team has to do it.
Coach buses, or do you guys get sleepers?
We got double deckers. There's no beds on them, but everyone here buys these. It's like a triple foldable bed that you buy on Amazon, and you lay it across the seats or under the seats. So,
yeah. One thing about hockey players is you learn how to sleep on a bus, like whether it's a double decker or a coach or a school bus. You figure out ways to get comfortable and find ways to fall asleep.
You try, man. It's for me, for a long time, it was hard. I have a terrible time getting comfortable on flights, even flights, bus, anywhere. It's really hard. But actually getting those beds this year off Amazon and sleeping on those was a game changer.
We didn't have, yeah, we took coaches everywhere in England, and like the worst, there's no, like, because those countries are so small, you very rarely stay over. So you have a game on Friday at home. You get home at like 11:30 PM. And then say you'd have to go to fight, like maybe the farthest, Dundee the next day. We'd have to be at the rink 4:30 AM, hop on a coach bus 8 hours, back's broken, play the game, hop back on the bus another 8 hours back. Like, I thought that was a grind for me. I wish there were more, I wish there were more sleeper buses. Like, I could deal with 8 hours if I'm lying down, but not when I'm trying to make myself comfortable with a seatbelt jabbing in my side. And
for sure. Here I live 25 minutes away from the rink. So, if we're leaving early, say 4 o'clock, I'm getting up at 3, leaving by 3:30 to get to the rink for 4. So I can pack my gear, get on the bus and head out to wherever we're going. And then, you got the games where you come back and you're home at 2-3 in the morning, you sleep for a little bit, you wake up, you get in your car, and you got to drive 25 minutes home. So it's not the easiest.
No, it's not. But
would you trade for anything though?
What's that? Yeah.
Would you trade that for anything else?
Nope. I'd retire if I would then.
Speaking of retirement, how many more years do you think you're going to play?
I don't know. A lot of factors go into that decision. See where the kids are at in a few years. My little girl's 2 now, and then I got a child on the way in July. And then, of course, how healthy I can stay. If my body feels good, I'd love to keep going for a while, and if the wife lets me too.
And post-hockey career, I know you talked before, coaching something you want to get into?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not quite sure yet. Hopefully I can play long enough that I can figure that out. But right now, yeah, I think I'd like to do some coaching afterwards.
Do you have any stories about just like wild stories that someone, like a North American hockey player, wouldn't believe about jumping over to Europe in any of the leagues? You didn't have to. I've heard some stories at different leagues, none of the ones you played in, but where guys like had to buy their own towels for the dressing room, or.
Well, we were buying shampoo this year. I mean, you have a team fund, and one of the rookies or something goes to the pharmacy and grabs a couple of bottles of shampoo and stuff like that. Little things like that. Towels are washed, once, twice a week, or things you take for granted back home. You're getting towel service, new towels every day.
When you said you had to go pack your own bag, I was like, light bulb went off. Guys think that the pro lifestyle is you show up to the rink, you get on the bus, your stuff's already packed. That's just not like that in Europe and in the coast even. So it's I'm glad that you hit that.
Yeah, I think the only place where bags would be packed up sometimes were in the American League. And I don't even think that was all the time.
Yeah, it's crazy. There's so many little differences. I know for us, we didn't have that machine that basically puts rivets in the skates.
Yeah.
So we didn't have one. So guys are playing with like loose rivets, and the only time that we can get it done was when we go to Cardiff, because they had one in their rink. So he would just wait until road games to fix your skates. And our trainer would be putting the skates together before games, and then we'd have to wait another, you know, 3-4 weeks if your skates broke. Things like that were just...
We had the same thing here this year. Like, our equipment manager, first of all, he was terrible. He was an unbelievable skate sharpener. Couldn't do anything else. Couldn't fix anything. The socks that we have here, for whatever reason, there's no elastic at the bottom. It's the worst thing I've ever seen. I don't understand why. I'm pretty sure it's like that in the DL as well. They just don't put elastics in the socks. And, you know, beginning of the year, I asked my equipment manager if he'd put an elastic in the bottom, and he was trying to charge me €5 for them. And I was like, are you serious? Like,
so you got boot cut socks.
Yeah. Boot cut socks. And then, like you said, that machine for rivets, our guy didn't know how to change rivets. He was putting in screws with washers to hold holders together. Like, something I'd never seen before. I was changing my own eyelets on my skates. Like, I literally would have the YouTube video up next to me, and I was like putting eyelets into my skates. Just little things like that you take for granted.
You're training for a career as equipment manager. You don't even know it.
Yeah. For a while, we didn't even have a skate sharpener on the road. So you would either have to ask the other team during an intermission to sharpen your skates, or you had to have a second or third set of steel. And finally, later in the season, we got a Pro Sharp, which, I mean, is okay. I mean, it gets the job done while you're on the road, but it's obviously not the best. So things like that, man.
T-blades out there?
T-blades, come on, Elmo.
The longest time, the only guy in the NHL that wore them was Dennis Seidenberg, and he was German. So,
yeah, the last game of the season that we played before we played, there was a public skate going on. We were playing in Ravensburg, and there was three kids on the ice ripping around in T-blades, and it was hilarious. I was just reminiscing on the Seidenberg days and when they first came out, and just how loud they are digging into the ice.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you can probably hear those kids from outside the building.
Yeah.
There's no way I thought I'd hear the reference of T-blades in my life.
Hey, those things came, and everybody thought they were going to be, you know, everybody's going to be wearing T-blades. And then it just ended at Seidenberg.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it looked like you were wearing rollerblades.
It did. And the blade, wasn't the blade like so thin?
It was. It was extremely thin. It was like literally like this.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know how, if you lost an edge or what, like, if you had to change the whole holder, if you could just pop the piece out, or... You'd
probably buy them 2 dozen at a time. Just a crate of them.
What's the skill level like for, you know, in terms of the German players themselves? Like, I know you guys are a lot, 4 imports?
Yeah, 4 imports. We had 3 forwards and me as a defenseman. A lot of teams had dual passports. So, I mean, there's a team like Heilbronn. They had like 9 foreigners or something like that, 10 foreigners, if you count their dual passport guys. So we had 1 dual passport. It was our goalie. And the rest were German or Swiss German or Czech German.
Skill level between the young German guys pretty good, or is there a big... Is it a pretty big, you know, drop off?
I mean, if you compare the young guys at the same age in Sweden and the young guys at the same age in Germany, to me there's a pretty big drop off. I don't know how to explain it. I think it's just, like I said, in Sweden, maybe there's a bit more development, being such a huge hockey country, than there is here in Germany.
Playing with your brother, your dad was often our team goalie coach and a guy I learned a ton from. Quietly, Patrick Wild goalie partner in Sherbrooke back in the day. And I always wondered, with guys who grew up with dads who played pro hockey, was he kind of all over you, telling you how to play, what you can do better, what you should be doing, or did he take more of a backseat and kind of let you guys figure it out as you go?
My dad's a huge backseat guy, very, very quiet at the rink. never in my life did I ever hear him yell at the rink during practice or game. The hardest he probably was on me during hockey was when he was my head coach and novice. You know, I think he kicked me off the ice a few times. He was always harder on me than anyone else out there. But no, never pushed me to play the game. Never tried to push me towards being a goalie or anything. You know, just let my brother and I kind of figure it out ourselves. And if we ever had any questions, he was there to answer them or give his opinion. But never forceful.
You know what? I noticed that with a lot of parents who played pro, they seem to be the ones that take the back seat. And it's usually the parents that didn't really play or don't really have a whole lot of experience with the game that are all over their kids about working hard and you got to do this and you got to do that. And to be honest, it just seems really counterproductive to do it that way. So knowing your dad a little bit, that's the exact answer that I would have expected. So that makes sense to me.
I think when you've experienced playing professional hockey and you kind of see the crap on the business side of things and stuff like that, not that you wouldn't want your kid to grow up and play professional hockey. I mean, I would never trade anything for my experience of playing pro hockey and stuff like that. But you understand more that, especially when they're young, you know, it's all about having fun and you don't want to push them too hard and force them to do something they don't want to do, and kind of letting them figure it out on their own. But I mean, the longer you play, I mean, Jamie, you've seen it, the crap on the business side of hockey, it's going to be there. It's there in minor hockey. It's there in professional hockey. Those are the kind of things that, you know, kind of push kids away from the game. And, you know, I mean, why put it on them when they're at such a young age, right? Let them figure it out themselves. When they're older, if they get a chance at pro hockey, then they can judge for themselves if that's something they want to be a part of or not.
So if your dad was a goalie growing up, how come he ended up putting the pads on and having a career as a pro goalie? You, not your dad, sorry.
I don't know. I think when I was younger, I tried it a few times. It was never as fun as scoring goals. And I mean, I started off as a forward and played forward until Adam or something like that. Then I was moved back to defense by a coach. And, it was just always more fun being able to skate around and play with the puck and score some goals rather than, you know, just be stuck in the net. You know, at a young age, you're not getting a whole lot of action as a goalie, so it's kind of boring. So I think that's probably why I didn't end up between the pipes.
All right, Nick, thanks for joining the pod. We really appreciate it. Best of luck getting home. Crazy times. Hopefully you're back in home soil and self-isolate or self-quarantine for you as soon as possible.
Yeah, thanks, guys. It was a pleasure, and hope to see you guys at Hammerstrang soon. I won't hold you down.